Hello, and welcome to Data Today, brought to you by Zulka. I'm your host, Dan Klein, and I oversee everything related to data and AI at Zulka. We're living in a world of opportunities, but to fully realise them, we have to reshape the way we innovate. We need to stop siloing data, ring-fencing knowledge, and adhering to traditional value chains, and that's what this podcast is about. We're taking a look at data outside the box to see how amazing individuals from disparate fields and industries are transforming the way they work with data, the challenges they're overcoming, and what we can all learn from them. In season two, we're exploring how we can use data to save the world, from helping people discover their history to combating fake news. We're going to be covering a lot of ground. We don't often think about how much is going on below our cities and towns. Beneath our feet is a complex system of water pipes, cables, and countless other elements that make up the wonderful world of the subsurface. It might surprise you to hear that the data that is associated with each critical element of this underground space is siloed. In other words, your water company won't necessarily know that they're about to cause a power outage until it's too late. No one has an entire view of the subsurface, which, in a world where we're so connected, sounds very antiquated. Something needs to change. Today's guest is someone who has spent his career trying to work out how to demystify this underground world. Holger Kessler is a renowned geoscientist who has racked up an astonishing 25 years at the British Geological Survey. He's just started a new role at AtkinsRéalis, but previously worked at the Government Office for Science as the science lead of the Future of Subsurface Foresight Programme. A mouthful, but very impressive, I think you'll agree. I want to start our conversation today by having Holger break down why subsurface data is so siloed.
So it's a really interesting point to do when we go to the geological map and the geological baseline data. The intention always was to gather information about the ground and its composition in a way that is applicable to as many users and use cases as possible. So the geological map, a bit like a topographic map, was meant to be non-silo specific. It was meant to serve environmental, resource, and planning purposes, as well as agricultural purposes. But the silofication does exist, and that is often to do with the fact that the information is there, but not enough people know about it and know how to access it and know how to utilize it. So we're looking at the FAIR principles, find, access, interoperability, reusability. They silify the geological information. Whereas with other silos, I think the first thing needs to happen is people who gather data on a specific topic, let's just say temperature or ground conditions or water levels or river flow, they're often not aware that their data might actually be useful and usable by other communities and other disciplines and other teams. So that is, I think, the harder silo to crack, to make people and organizations aware that their information isn't just for their own purposes, but it could be for others. If they do certain changes to the way they collect or the way they share people, that it could actually have outcomes for others. And that leads us to my current work in the underground asset register space, where we are now looking at future use cases for digital data on pipes and cables. And of course, there are, if you put things together in the right way, there are many, many more opportunities and much more value to be derived than having just your own bit of data for yourself.
Can we take a step back? How would you describe, to the average person in the street, how would you describe the role that you've been doing for the last 10 years or so? How would you describe it to somebody in the pub?
Yeah, great question. I would say we're trying to make the invisible visible. We're trying to make the subsurface space more tangible, more accessible. Shining a light into the subsurface. It's the out of sight, out of mind issue with the subsurface. We store waste in the subsurface. We extract heat, water, minerals, but that's all sort of happening in a very hidden space. And my whole role from mapping geology at the beginning to now working on the digitalization of subsurface data and making accessible is about that. The more we can explain and demonstrate to the person in the street or pub what the subsurface is made of and what it's there for, the more likely we are to treat it in the right way and utilize it in the right way.
When you talk about the subsurface, you're talking about system of, in some senses, it's a system of systems, isn't it? So it's many different things at many different levels. And of course, it's three-dimensional, which is, of course, an interesting challenge. How do you express that to all the different parties that might be interested in what is going on? How do you communicate that and the utility of it, if you like?
That's the challenge we have. I'm grateful you mentioned systems of systems. So we have the combination of water, plants, the solid earth, energy, which can be in form of conventional oil and gas, but also we have cool and heat, and also, of course, the engineered system, all entangled and interacting with each other. So the challenge when we think about these words like a digital twin or a digital replication of that system is that if we put it all in front of someone with all its complexities, it's overwhelming. It's too much information and too much complexity. What we're trying to do is to, and then we're getting quickly into silos, so we're getting into the sort of potentially negative consequence. We're trying to cut the subsurface into the system parts and, for example, have a national map and model or digital twin of all the buried infrastructure. And then we're trying to have a national map or even model of the water system. So we have at the Environment Agency models of the groundwater with monitoring wells. So we are trying to understand the parts of the system. And then hopefully, if we need to work between the different systems, the data and the models should be interoperable and should be informing each other. But as you started off, it is a very complex system of systems. And of course, the difference to the above ground with where technologies, drone, airborne, all the way to satellites, are much easier deployed to measure and capture the system, including the human system, as in the movement of people. We can capture all of that much easier and much more live than we can in the subsurface due to the fact that it is just largely inaccessible.
So you've obviously mentioned the word engineered systems, and the opposite of that is non-engineered systems. Can you explain? I have an appreciation that you care about trees and flora and fauna when it comes to the geology of the subsurface, but can you explain the relationship here between things like water pipes and electricity cables and fiber broadband and how that relates to the more natural world stuff of watercourses and rivers and flora and fauna and trees? What's the relationship there for our listeners?
So as a geographer, I will go into a particular geography. So if we take one of our major cities or towns, pretty much everything is part of the engineered system. So we have very few places on the world where we have had no human impact. So that's as a sort of scene setter, we live in the Anthropocene. So humans have had an impact on all the system, including the deep groundwater systems and the energy systems. But if we go into a place in central Manchester, even the trees, even the flora and fauna is part of an engineered, a planned system, because we have eradicated everything natural in the first place and have then replanned the city. And then what I'm trying to say is even the natural system in most places in the UK and any other developed populated nation is part of an engineered system. But I would say the boundaries of those sort of subsystems are the steel and concrete part of the engineered system and tarmac. That is generally considered the engineered infrastructure. And then anything that grows and lives in between. We also have an interesting, we have an archaeological, we have cultural heritage. So we have also got our historically engineered system has is beginning to be amalgamated into what you can consider the soil and therefore the living system. And then there are lots of interactions. We have the living systems, the roots, the animals, and the microbes interacting with our built infrastructure. We have the water system responding to abstraction and infiltration and rainfall, and we have water systems warming up, cooling down, which has an effect on life, and all of that has an effect on the infrastructure, whether it's a basement that has issues with groundwater flooding, or whether they are pipes and cables that are at risk of corrosion or at risk of movement due to the soil drying out because trees take water out of the system. So there were a few examples, but there are many others. And I think breaking down the silos, Dan, it's an interesting one we're getting into here is, first of all, we need to break down the silos in terms of how we conceptualize and how we understand the systems. And that is systems thinking, to be clear that none of these systems exist in isolation, that they all interact with each other. So before we talk about how we do digital twin modeling, mapping, data models, we need to, first of all, get loads of people and organizations on the same page to say, well, whatever you do above and below ground has an impact on other parts.
There is no country, city, or town in the world that has a complete view of its subsurface. However, the Netherlands has probably managed to get the closest. They've created exactly what Holger is talking about, a 3D digital twin of the country's entire underground world. The power of this is huge. It allows for practical decisions to be made on a local level, but also empowers the Geological Survey of the Netherlands to track larger changes in climate impact. The question is, why aren't more countries, cities or towns doing something similar? What's stopping subsurface data being shared more widely?
Before we get into data and data sharing and technologies, which are barriers to uptake and utilization of all these clever techniques, technologies and systems we've got, before we go into that, I think one of the first hurdles is that our administrative, regulatory, managerial system. So above all, the natural and the built systems are organizational systems. So how we manage and allocate space for building, for energy, for food production, and how we then maintain and monitor or even regulate those systems. Those systems are centuries old, have grown over many, in some cases, over hundreds of years, and they haven't kept up with the increasing complexity, also the density of people and organizations and interactions. And then layered on top of it all, it's of course the pressures we're seeing as a consequence of climate change. So really, for the person in the street to see an effect of all these amazing tools we have to monitor, to measure, to predict future events, for that to have an impact on you and I living in our town, we need change, systematic change in the way we manage, plan, regulate the environment and the space. And we have there's an interesting graph in a book, Technology Fallacy, I think it was called, where you have increasing uptake of technologies on the individual level, and then there's an increasing lag over time how that gets adopted and assimilated into the operational or institutional level, and then finally into the public policy space. So the public sector lags behind increasingly, and you can see this by how much we are able to, when you go into the academic sphere, you read some papers or listen to some podcasts about, let's say, prediction of future events in terms of weather and what effects that might have on our transport and groundwater system, and then you go and visit your district council or your local regulatory agency, and you compare the reality of decision making and how that is handled with what is possible, I think you find there's an increasingly widening gap.
And how do we fix that gap?
I'm a strong advocate, so I've had several secondments in my life. Latest was from the British Geological Survey to the Cabinet Office, and previously I've been working inside the Environment Agency, and I think a good start is to mix up people, to have industry secondments into academia, take researchers out to spend some time inside government policy teams. So I think mixing the cultures would be a very good start. And then, of course, we can go straight to one of our favorite topics, which is the data sharing. Safe, secure, legal, and mindful data sharing, because we can't easily share all data with everyone for every purpose, but that also comes into play. And then we have technologies. We need to make sure we create software and applications that are usable and useful and affordable in the public sector, in local authorities. Let's just name local authorities here, without having a massive resource implication.
I've had a long-standing beef in the market, in the data world, talking to different organisations about the emphasis on data science over data engineering. And I'm just interested in your views. I hold extremely strong views that we have to engineer the sharing, the access. The way that we use data has to be engineered before we can apply all this data science and all this extremely clever. Everybody gets very excited about all this, you know, deep learning, machine learning, large language models. Unless we've engineered the data for access, we've engineered the data for ethical use, so we've engineered the data so that it moves around correctly, we're kind of on a hiding to nothing, are we not?
I 100% agree. I've been in the academic sector. I am fully subscribed to the need for blue skies thinking and research, fundamental research. And so there's nothing wrong with exploring and creating proof of concepts. But I feel with the pressures we're seeing in everyday life from the impacts of climate change and all the consequences, food security, energy security, spaces, safe space to live, flooding, extreme rainfall, heat waves, I think we need to focus less on experimentation for this moment in time and more on deployment. And your point is the data that underpins the decision-making, the algorithms, the tool that data scientists are playing with needs to be portable onto the operational side. In other words, it's nice to do some experiments in a laboratory. It could be also be non-data experiments. If you then can't operationalize that tool for the whole country. And back to one of the success stories with the National Underground Asset Register, we have absolutely, use your words again, we have engineered, hard engineered, the way we are sharing these pieces of national critical infrastructure data with these stakeholders. And we're now exploring painstakingly how we can now share that data with more users and more user groups without breaking the system. And I think that's hard work. I totally agree.
You were talking about regulation there, and I'm minded by the fact that there's a political topic that has reared its head in the last month because there's a private members bill going through Parliament on street scarring. I'm conscious that on the surface, it's a very well understood concept of a town council who upgrades a town centre, and then the next thing that happens is a utilities company digs up a trench and fills it in with tarmac and destroys this beautiful new town centre. And obviously this private members bill is going through and is getting quite a lot of airtime, quite a lot of coverage. Can you describe to our listeners why what you do is such an integral part of what on the surface is trying to solve the local built environment for the town centre of a local council? What is it about what you're doing that absolutely underpins this discussion around street scarring and the impact it's having on our built environment?
At the lowest level, we're hoping that if we share information, data and information of what is below the surface and where it is, that will inevitably lead to better coordination and collaboration between people who have the need to open up the street space. So coordination should be a direct consequence of better data sharing between the utilities, the highways authorities, and future organizations such as district heating companies. So that should be a direct consequence. But also, I think there's a deeper case here for, let's just use that word, of democratization of the information. If we make it more transparent, so back to your question in the beginning, what's the reason for my being? To make the underground, the subsurface, more transparent, more visible, more accessible to people. If the town council and the highways authorities and the local power and utility providers can engage with the citizens about subsurface interactions or interventions more transparently, i.e. you can show everybody why does this job need to get done in a certain place at a certain time, I think we will have much more democratic discourse and much more buy-in for certain interventions. How you do the job and how you leave the job behind is, of course, another whole discussion. There are actually, I'll give you another answer to this. We have been using directional drilling in the oil and gas industry for decades. We can actually push utilities into either existing ones, and that's already happening. Water mains replacements often happen without the need to dig. With better information about the subsurface and its makeup, its conditions, its soil type, etc., and where all the utilities are, might allow town squares to not be dug up continuously, but we might be able to weave new utilities underneath.
The reason street scarring happens is because of Section 70, Clause 4, of the New Roads and Streetworks Act 1991. A sexy title, I know. The Act enables utility firms to get in and out as quickly as possible and only asks that the road surface is replaced like for like within 6 months. And the fine for not doing this is currently only £2,500. So inevitably, you get not only a tar-covered mess of a street scarring, but lots of open wounds in town centres. It looks messy, and citizens clearly don't like it. I would imagine a lot of people don't know what goes on underneath their feet, and only get to see it when shoddy work like this is done in their local communities. Hopefully, Holger's life mission to reveal a full 3D version of the underground world will only encourage local authorities to help citizens understand what's going on down there a little better. Holger has done some fantastic work trying to push this mission in London over the last few years.
If we had a more clearer map and understanding of what's underground in a city like London, we could utilize space, and there are many existing underground spaces that are currently not used at all. They could be air raid shelters, previous tunnels, transport tunnels, and tube stations. We could, for starters, make much more efficient use of existing space underground for putting facilities, infrastructure, which currently is above ground. So a good example are sewage treatment works. I mean, they're large things, but in some places in the world, we're beginning to put infrastructure, which takes up a lot of space, above ground, underground, to make space for green and blue infrastructure and living. We're extending basements already, relatively uncontrolled, into the subsurface in London. We could do that much more thoughtful and do it in the right areas to the right depth. We will then benefit from cooler places. We could plan future tunnels and future transport infrastructure without sterilizing space and occupying the wrong space. So spatial planning, as I said before, would be the best outcome. The next big topic for London is, we touched on this a little bit, is tree plant, greening the city. We will be able to make much better decisions on where to put trees, drainage infrastructure, green suds, drainage ponds, to maximize their benefit, but without impacting on existing and, again, potential future utilities. So it all comes back to what I said very much at the beginning. It's subsurface spatial planning is the end game.
But what you're describing here is it's really touching in some senses, particularly when we talk about energy and water and transport networks. We're touching on critical national infrastructure. How does this get a shot in the arm, an injection from people within the critical national infrastructure world who say, actually, this is something we really should start caring about because it is so fundamental to ensuring we don't have flooding, ensuring we continue to have water, ensuring that our energy supplies are not disrupted and our transportation is not disrupted. What's the momentum from the critical national infrastructure perspective to really resolve this?
As part of my last year in the Government Office for Science, we've led a foresight project called The Future of the Subsurface, which we'll be publishing hopefully in March. And we have reached out to departments and also the National Infrastructure Commission. And we do see, whether it's a shot in the arm or whether it's a small twisting of the arm, we are seeing increasing engagement and awareness in departments concerned with energy. Geothermal energy for both heating and cooling is really raising its head. The space congestion element that I've touched on several times, the national critical infrastructure, here in particular the drinking water supply, is forcing the issue. I am seeing a bit of a momentum building across government and not just central, but also local governments. We've reached out to Glasgow City Council. We've talked to Scottish Government, we've talked to Welsh Government and colleagues in Belfast. The awareness is increasing everywhere. Data accessibility and availability is increasing. And I think I'm hopeful that we're seeing an uptake. We're seeing more mindfulness about the subsurface than it was the case 5-10 years ago.
What would your takeaway be for people about the work that you do and the impact it has on us and the planet?
We are working in a hidden part of the world. There's very few geologists, very few subsurface engineers, and the impact we underpin a lot. We underpin so many functions and roles, and we are excited that we are able to be more present and be more visible. And when you talk to people, like you mentioned the proverbial person in the pub, about what we do, everybody says, oh, I didn't know all this underpinning infrastructure, all this stuff was going in the subsurface. So I really am excited with this podcast and with everything we do that we are increasing people's awareness of where their water comes from, what the houses are built on, where the materials come from, where the potential of geothermal energy. And I'm excited that that will lead to much more buy-in and much more mindful treatment of our natural and built environments.
We're already starting to think innovatively about how we might use the existing infrastructure beneath our feet. For example, there's an old World War II bunker 33 metres below the streets of Clapham in South London that was repurposed as a hydroponics farm in the mid-2010s. Imagine the possibility of something like this rolled out on a wider scale. The implications are exciting and speak to a wider point about using what we have to make our lives better. Business ecosystems are not new. What is new is that they're becoming increasingly data-empowered. To realise complex opportunities, we need innovation beyond boundaries, democratised information, and close collaboration between diverse players. Collaborative, data-empowered, borderless innovation is how we embrace a world of exponential change. Thanks for listening to Data Today, brought to you by Zulca. I've been your host, Dan Klein. For more information on Zulca's work, please visit our website.